Well, hell yeah. Welcome to the Center for Indigenous Midwifery's podcast. Our mission is strengthening community by honoring, supporting, and reclaiming Indigenous midwifery care and culturally centered family support. For more information on our programming, visit indigenous-midwifery.org, find us on social media, or tune in for a live Zoom cast offered each month. Thank you so much for listening.
Welcome, everyone. So happy to see you all. So happy to be here. I am so honored to be sharing in the circle with you tonight and talking about our beautiful traditional foods and their importance in the postpartum period. I'm really particularly excited because the topic is so near and dear to me, and tonight I'm going to actually be sharing an excerpt from my full postpartum Indigenous doula training. And so we have a really comprehensive and really fantastic program, and I pulled out some pieces of that to share with you all tonight. And I'll introduce myself. I am Rayanne Madison. I am an enrolled member of the Boy Sport Band of Chippewa Indians. I am in the Crane Clan. I also have Mexica heritage as well as mixed European heritage, including English, French, Spanish, and Dutch. My Dutch ancestors came to Michigan in the year 1920. I am born and raised in Anishinaabe territories here in Michigan in the Great Lakes. Feel so, so blessed to be doing the work that I get to do from this really, really beautiful place that I feel really connected to. I am a mother of three. I am a full spectrum Indigenous doula and community educator, and I've been working with families across the reproductive lifespan for almost 15 years. My initiation into birth work was really the birth of my own daughter, as is the story for so many of us, and haven't stopped since. I am the founder of the Postpartum Healing Lodge, which is a grassroots Indigenous doula training program that provides community birth and professional birth work education to people all over the world. Feels so weird to say that, but since November 2019, both in person and online, we have welcomed over 1,300 people through our various programs, including 400 direct care doulas in Black and Indigenous communities all over Turtle Island. I am a board member of the Michigan Breastfeeding Network, and in my regular day job, I work as a state breastfeeding trainer and an Indigenous breastfeeding liaison for our state WIC program, which is the Women, Infants, and Children program. I've found a lot of help in starting circles like this with a quick prayer and a smudge, which I've already done beforehand, and then with a card pull. And pulling cards for me is really about centering myself and just connecting to the message, and gives me some direction and as well as helps me just quiet down and settle down for when I'm ready to teach. So I have this really fantastic deck. It's called the Daily Affirmation Card Deck. 30 affirmations for Indigenous women and girls. And it's written and designed by Minopi Matsuin, who's the creator of the Instagram store, Cute Cree Crafts. And she has a really fantastic deck that I like to pull from at the beginning of any presentation. So you're welcome to listen and reflect upon these words if you'd like. I pulled three cards. The first says, everything I learn will be used for the good of myself, my family, and my community. One day I will be the elder my community needs. The second card says, I have all the tools to achieve my dreams. There are people I have never even met who are cheering for me and hoping that I succeed. And then the third and final card says, every step I take is ceremony. And with that, I'll go ahead and begin our presentation. which I have titled Remembering Nettles, Traditional Postpartum Nourishment. And we're really focusing in on the immediate postpartum period. And of course, a lot of us are coming back to our traditional and original understanding of what postpartum means. It's kind of a weird word in the English language, post meaning after and partum meaning the pregnancy. A lot of us have been reclaiming this term. We know that there's a history of postpartum being used as sort of shorthand or abbreviation for postpartum mood disorders, in particular postpartum depression. And there's been a lot of movement in recent years to reclaim the use of that word to describe the really important time of care and integration that is really part of a continuation of our life ways and ceremonies as Indigenous people. And so this particular time period is the moments after the birth of, the end of any pregnancy, but in particular, this focus is going to be on a live birth and after the birth of the baby and after the birth of the placenta. We do have some time frames that we could conceptualize when we talk about postpartum care and nourishment. And generally, across a lot of global cultures, that period of time is roughly 4 to 6 weeks. However, as we go through, we'll talk about why any and all postpartum nourishment is appropriate. And there's different ways that families can access postpartum care. We know that it's not equitable for everybody and not appropriate for every single circumstance and not accessible to every single circumstance. So there's no prescription here. Everything is just shared in a really good, heartfelt way. And why remembering nettles? Why talk about nettles? Nettles to me is so important and so foundational to my practice as an Indigenous doula and really to my own self-care. I grew up with nettles and I remember not actually knowing what they were until I went to college because my mom was one of those people that she didn't directly teach me things. Like, she never sat me down and was like, here are the nettles, here's how you cook this dish, here's what to do with venison, and here's how she was total like learn by experience. And now I'm going back in my memories and piecing together all the things that she really did teach me, but it was more the pedagogy of like watch and learn. And so she would say to us, myself and my two younger sisters, don't run through the nettles because it'll sting you. And I remember thinking in my brain as a child that it was bees, like that if I went into the nettles, that the bees would sting me. She never really explained that it was actually the nettles plant itself that would sting us. And so, of course, I would just run through the nettles all the time and it would sting the crap out of me. And I could never figure out why that was happening until I reconnected with the plant a few years after that in college in a much more intentional way, like drinking the tea and then starting to work with it as a food source in other ways, cooking it and preparing it in different kinds of medicinal concoctions. So nettles to me is something that extends all the way back into my childhood, even though I never knew what it meant when my mom would say, don't run through the nettles. But I did. And maybe that kept me healthy in some ways or give me a stronger relationship to this plant. I have a teacher, her name is Kathy. She's such a fantastic Anishinaabe Kwe. She taught me that in our culture, in Ojibwe culture, we have this belief that every plant and every tree is really a person. And the spirit of that plant or the spirit of that tree is underneath it all the same as us. And way back in time, we all shared the same language and we could speak to animals and we could speak to the plants and to the trees because we were just spirits communicating with one another. we have very different relationships to the world around us now for many valid, various diverse reasons. However, we still have this underlying understanding that there's a spirit there, and those names are reflected in our language. And so I've tried to connect with plants and trees in this way, rather than viewing them as just a resource to be picked or to be made into food or to be made into tea, to take being in relationship to them. And I try to be intentional. I can't do that with every single food source, and I can't do that with every single plant and every medicine, but it's just an inquiry and a constant striving to do that and to be in right relationship. And so I've tried to slow down with certain plants, and nettles is one of them. And I've had such a fantastic connection to them in the way that they have presented themselves to me. The spirit that's underneath this nettles plant is a man. And so I'll sometimes call nettles him or he, because I've had, you know, connection with them and the spiritual realm, and the way that nettles comes to me as a young native man who looks just like a normal man that you could see, today. I've had, you know, a dream of him coming to me and like speaking to me, and he was just in like a baseball cap and had like the long ponytail, and he was just dressed like normal. It wasn't like an old time, you know, ancestor dream, but he's here in the modern day and he's present with me. So that's why I come back to remembering nettles. And I say remembering because maybe some of you also ran through the nettles as a child and forgot what that felt like. And tonight it'll spark some reconnection to this plant, but there's such an important part of the landscape here in the Great Lakes region, but is common to certainly many cuisines and cultural landscapes all around the world. And so I find it to be a really fantastic one for a lot of us to reconnect to our land and to our food ways, even if we've been disconnected for many different valid reasons. And if you have any stories about nettles, I encourage you to write them down, and perhaps at the end we can come back together to share. Why are postpartum foods so important? This is something that I think about all the time, and I'm constantly questioning and coming back to, and it really interrogating how can we live in such an inequitable society, you know, coming from the perspective of an Indigenous woman in the United States. How can I be advocating for postpartum foods when the world around us is so difficult at times? And what's really the purpose? Can we get to some understanding of the importance of these foods? We can hold the fact that food access isn't equitable to many of our people and still strive for and advocate for an understanding of their importance. Ancestral foods to me are not just about taking in nutrients, taking in calories, taking in flavors. For me, when I sit down to a cup of something or a bowl of something, I really try to remember that it is a true blessing that I am able to connect to a piece of my people's history, my people's land, my people's waters. And the whole entire history of who I am is contained in this little cup of something. And I try to remember how sacred and amazing it is. And I think about the history of how something as simple as a cup of pumpkin soup really tells a story of our entire history as Indigenous people. Where did that come from? Who carried those seeds? How far back do we have to reach to find this pumpkin? You know, what's the history and story of that? So that's for me what's so special about our ancestral foods. They're not just products that we take in, but they're really a method of storytelling and culture keeping. And they are so healing to bodies in postpartum. And like I said, we're focusing in this immediate postpartum period. So the moments after birth, And there are for sure so many diverse teachings and understandings and cuisine traditions and stories and protocols in cultures all around the world for what is to be encouraged to be eaten in postpartum and what are the taboo foods for postpartum. So I've tried to encapsulate some that are specific to my community here, as well as a synthesis of learning from a lot of different teachers and resources. And there's definitely a strong influence of traditional Chinese medicine in the way that I learn and teach, because TCM has been so healing for me to connect with on a self-care level, because it helps to fill in the gaps to a lot of the stories and sort of little bits and pieces that I've grown up hearing, but never really had an Anishinaabe person to sit me down and be like, okay, here's why we do this because of this organ, or here's why we eat these foods because of this effect on the body. Whereas TCM has such a rich documented history. And so I just wanted to give that acknowledgement. And of course, they've, you know, TCM has really been so revolutionary in the way that teachers and carriers of those cultures and traditions have been at the forefront of revitalizing postpartum nutrition and care within the dominant society. So just wanted to give that acknowledgement and say that there's, you know, lots of different ways of presenting and preparing postpartum foods. So I'm going to try to give some general recommendations for foods that are to be eaten in those moments after birth. Now, these could be, you know, the one postpartum meal that a family gets to eat. Sometimes it's called the victory meal, but it could be that one special dish that is prepared for them. And that alone is so full of medicine and so sacred on its own. And in some families, this type of nutrition and framework for healing is applied to the entire first 40 days after birth, or the entire first 30 days or 42 days, depending on the traditions. And so it's not to say that you have to do this 100% of the time for so many days, or else you're not healing correctly or you're not doing it right. I think a more is more approach is not appropriate for a lot of our people for a lot of different ways, and the reasons that we've been disconnected from our food sovereignty, and that any and all of this good medicine is good for our postpartum families. So none of this is meant to be prescriptive in any way. There are some qualities of postpartum foods that we're going to be looking for. And in general, what we're looking for with those foods are that first and foremost, they are served hot. And if they can't be served hot, then they are served warm. And if they can't be served warm, then they're served at room temperature. We try to avoid cold, especially ingesting cold in the immediate postpartum period. And there's a lot of reasons for this, because one, cold is perceived by the body to be threatening when we're in such a vulnerable period. Cold, like, reaches back into our history and touches a part of us that remembers when cold means, you know, our wigwam got blown over by a storm, or we had to flee, you know, camp from warfare, or we were stuck outside and, you know, that the cold could kill us if we didn't make it back into warmth and safety. So warmth equals safety in this sort of cellular level. And that certainly translates to one of the most vulnerable times in our life, which is when we complete this most epic ceremony of birth. And so everything is warm, warm, warm. And we want to avoid cold going into the body, because that can cause excess pain. It can cause delay in milk production. It can lead to cold womb syndrome, which can lead to menstrual cycle problems later on in life. It can lead to extra cramping, lower back pain. Some of the ways that we've sort of normalized pain and suffering in the postpartum period can potentially be linked to coldness. And so almost all traditional postpartum care is really centered around protecting the body through the application of warmth. Warm, 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 everything. And so when your aunties told you not to go outside with wet hair and not to walk barefoot on the floor and not to go to bed with wet hair and not to drink ice water on your period, that is auntie wisdom at the core. It's abuela wisdom. It's granny wisdom that tells us, yeah, our aunties always knew what they were talking about when they scolded us for all of those things. We're looking for foods that are easy to digest. And I invite you to think about things that you eat that you are very easily able to digest. Like the things you eat that you feel satiated when you eat them, but you don't feel it sitting in your gut for like a whole day after, and you don't feel real sleepy afterwards. You have a strong metabolism and you easily integrate nutrients. That's what's meant by easy to digest. And typically these are things that are fully cooked as well as soft in texture, mushy and liquidy, almost kind of like baby foods, things that are real soft and just luscious in that way. And if you think about things that are round and kept in a bowl or kept in a mug, that's the spirit of what we're looking for here. In a lot of customs, there are, you know, they prioritize in those first moments after birth, having things that are simple and sweet rather than acidic and very spicy or hot. And I mean hot as in like on the tongue. And the reason is because your body after birth, you know, you've just been through such an epic ceremony. Lots of things are shifting back into place. The hormones are working. Everything is healing. And it's a lot to take in. And so our digestion will automatically be diminished in birth because our body only has so much energy and so many calories to give to like literally pushing a baby out and then all of the healing that needs to happen after that, you know, or preserving our safety, you know, during and after a cesarean birth. So digestion's like the first thing to go when a body has gone through something so epic. And we start with things that are simple and sweet because they're easier to digest and they just give that little like warm hug, you know, rather than a slap. If you think about the energetics of food and how it's prepared, like we don't need strong, you know, we just want real simple. And we want things that are full of fat and full of oils, things that, you know, we don't shy away from oils. We have, of course, all of our traditional oils in all of our various cultures and butter and ghee and, you know, just everything with a sleek shine of fat in it. We don't want to undertake a low fat diet at this point in time because those are real lubricating to the brain, which supports our mental health, lubricating to our digestion, and reduces air in the body. Our body can feel kind of empty and airy after giving birth just because we released so much. We released the baby, we released the placenta, all the amniotic fluid, the blood, the sweat, the tears, everything is just like wet, wet, wet. And then all of a sudden we're left in this kind of empty state, and that's air inside. So we sweep it away with a lot of fat and oil. I've had very different experiences in ceremony with foods. I've really enjoyed very flavorful things after all of my births. I've never been bothered by things that were too spicy. However, I had such a different experience when I recently accompanied my dog or doula my dog through his death. He was at home with us and he died of natural causes, and we were with him and we were holding him and talking to him and just helping him as he made that transition in our arms. And that ceremony of life, which is in the opposite direction as birth, was so very different for me in the hours that followed. I found that I couldn't eat anything too strong because it was just so overwhelming to my senses. And I went into those real simple postpartum foods to sort of slowly bring me back to myself spiritually, but also just to give my digestive system like a little bit of an extra break, because I couldn't even bite things that I had to bite. I could only take things that could be slurped or just drank straight up. So I thought, I wonder if a lot of birthing people would prefer those kind of foods too. Things that are real easy, that you don't have to cut through, that are just easy to like slurp, and you know, anything that's too overwhelming to the senses is the reason why we start simple and sweet. This has also definitely been confirmed by my Vision Quest sisters who, you know, when they come out of 4 days of fasting, no food and water, and we prepare, you know, back in the kitchen, like a huge feast, and we have tamales and we have tortillas and we have wild rice and we have all the fruit and we have like taco, you know, like we have everything, and they come out and they're like, we don't want to even smell food, let alone like all they want is like some broth with beans, right? They don't want like all of this big stuff. So we start simple and sweet and, you know, just prepared with a lot of love for that first meal after birth. And here in the Great Lakes region, a lot of Anishinaabe really prize fish, in particular whitefish. And it's funny because when I teach in outside communities, when I say whitefish, people don't always know what that means, because it's a specific fish to this area, which I didn't know until I started working with people all around the world. And they're like, what do you mean whitefish? I'm like, whitefish. Like, it's whitefish, like the fish that we grew up, like it's our most, you know, important fish and like one of our most important food sources. But our traditional food here is fish broth with, you know, cooked with the whole fish, including the fish head. And, you know, it's just such a very light and easy kind of broth. It's not a real heavy and super duper spicy and flavorful broth, just really, really simple. And, you know, it's just the pieces of the fish that are in there. So that in a lot of Anishinaabe communities is the traditional food that's given in funeral ceremonies, but also birthing ceremonies. And just love the connections across our different ceremonies across our whole lifespan. So some examples of the postpartum foods that are so very healing and supportive to our birthing bodies, of course, broths, soups, and stews. Broth versus stock, this is a really interesting discussion. And if you're super geeky about things like I am, then you can go into like a whole rabbit hole about stock versus broth. Growing up, my mom would make stock, but she never called it that. She would just make it. And she never taught me how, but her stock was very simple. She would put the carcasses of the chickens, and it would be onions chopped, celery chopped, and carrots chopped in like a bay leaf and salt and pepper. And that was the stock that she made. And she never taught me how, and she never used any other kind. Like, it was always chicken stock. And then somewhere along the line, the word bone broth got introduced into my vocabulary. And then this concept of bone broth just took off. And a lot of people are talking about bone broth. And so I've started calling it that just because it's kind of like what the vernacular is. But if you speak to somebody who went to culinary school, they're like, it's a stock, it's not a broth. But it is this, you know, liquid that has been cooked over a slow period of time, generally with vegetables, aromatic herbs, healing herbs, and either a vegetarian version with just those things and maybe some mushrooms and bones from chicken, from turkey, from, you know, deer, elk, from beef, from lamb, all different kinds. And I like to use that as the base for just about everything that I cook, because there's so many benefits to having that. In bone broth or stock is so culturally significant to me as an Ojibwe as well. And soups and stews, they're just the perfect vehicle for serving somebody food in postpartum. It's easy to slurp. It meets all the qualities, those positive qualities that we just talked about. It's a great way to have diversity in flavor. In some cultures, I know it's the same. So it's like the same soup every day and you eat it three times a day. But, you know, sometimes we want to have a little diversity in our diet. So there's so many, you know, infinite possibilities of what you can do with a cup of soup. And for drinking, of course, we're staying away from cold. So we're really prioritizing hot teas, you know, hot herbal teas, especially hot chocolate, hot cider, etc. And I remember after my second birth, I wanted apple cider, and it was just at the beginning of winter here in Michigan. It was in November and it was just starting to snow and get really cold here. We have four seasons and our winter is pretty long and pretty harsh. I was like, the first thing I really, really want is hot cider. And thankfully I had a home birth, so I was able to have hot cider right away. I actually had a crock pot plugged in that just had the cider in it. And as soon as that popped that baby out, I was like, get me my cider. And that was the first thing that I was drinking after I had birthed him. In a lot of cultures, corn is so sacred. And I love the discussion about corn. We could talk for hours about it. And oh, it just brings us, so many of us, together as Indigenous people, because we have such a strong connection to this relative and such an interesting history in the ways that corn and maize have been, you know, taken around the world from its birthplace, and the care and the keeping of this sacred relative. I just have so much love for this relative of maize. And there's a lot of stigmatization of corn. And I think a lot of us probably grew up in like the corn, you know, like you're corn fed, or remember the documentary, I think it was called King Corn, and it was all about like corn syrup and just the ways that, you know, dominant settler society have really diminished our relationship to this sacred relative and diminished our sovereignty around caring and keeping this relative. And the ways that we've resisted that, I think, are super duper badass. So I love corn. And I'm trying to normalize eating corn in our community. And a lot of people are still like scared to eat it because they've heard, you know, all these stories about it's so bad for us, it doesn't have any nutrition, da 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 da. When really it's that we've been disconnected from our wisdom and our keeping of this sacred relative. So there's whole entire traditions around corn-based products, and especially drinks and porridges, such as atoles and champurrados and corn mush and grits and other things that are made with corn that usually is toasted, covered with water, maybe some sweetener or some cacao or some roasted pumpkin. You know, there's different traditions in a lot of our lineages, and I just really love and appreciate the ability to uplift that sacred relative in this space. And I'm all about keeping things easy and accessible. So taking the food that we would normally prepare in other ways and making it appropriate for postpartum, simple is better. So meats and veggies, like all the meats and veggies, baked, stewed, or roasted, or even steamed, because that meets all the qualities of making it soft and easy to digest. And I'm a huge fan of the sheet tray. So just all of the things chopped, with a lot of oil, some herbs, salt, and pepper, keep it simple. And you can put your fish or your meat in there with it as well. Porridge. So again, you're seeing the themes here, everything round, everything well-cooked, everything spoon, everything slurping. So rice and grains, again, connecting with our traditional wisdom and letting go of the ways that rice and grains have been stigmatized by dominant settler culture, the way that nutrition science is often wrong about our traditional foods. So it's a lot of porridges. And then tamales. I have loved connecting with tamales as a postpartum food. Have a dear friend and colleague in the Postpartum Healing Lodge doula community who brought this knowledge to us and shared how pumpkin tamales and rabbit and turkey tamales have been historically revered postpartum food in many Indigenous communities since time immemorial. And it's such a great thing to learn how to do because you can make so many at once and then it just stretches, you know, our ability to feed ourselves and our people. So absolutely love playing around with different kinds of fillings for the tamal and even just playing with nothing inside. And then casseroles are, if you're from my community back home in Minnesota, it's hot dish and like, it's a fight. Like if you say casserole, it'd be like, they will correct you so fast. It's hot dish. And then here in Michigan, it's called casserole. You say hot dish, they don't know what you're talking about. But you know what I mean? Like rice or noodles or something at the base with other things in it. And usually it's going to be like a big pan of it. And it's so great to feed a bigger family or to make a big meal that can be portioned out for leftovers. And I love to take all of these things and add in any extra flavor and nutrition wherever I can, especially with nettles, because when we, you know, our nettles growing seasons in the spring and then in the fall again, and we can get a lot and it'll come back after you harvest it. So you can get a lot of dried nettles, and nettles tends to be somewhat accessible via, you know, online shops or community herbalists in your area. And I sprinkle that on everything. So the salt bay meme where he's just like with the salt, like that is me with the nettles. So I'll put in nettles and everything. I put it in my broths. I put it in my tamales. I put it in casseroles. I put it on top of other food as like a flavoring and as an extra way of getting all the benefits of that and all the nutrition, as well as preserving my connection to that person. And then infused water served warm or room temperature. So people who do not enjoy drinking hot tea, and not everyone does, and not everyone likes drinking herbal tea, but if you're getting tired of drinking just plain old water, or if letting go of smoothies and your iced coffee and iced tea for a week or so is really hard to do, then sometimes people really prefer to have infused waters that are served at room temperature. So just, you know, a bottle that has lemon or nettles or lemon balm, or, you know, there's so many different combinations, but often that can get them through until they're ready to start back with their iced teas or whatever it is that they need to have. So not everyone wants to sit down and drink something hot, then they can have it at room temperature. It just keeps things interesting too. And you know, when you're breastfeeding at 3 a.m. and everyone else is asleep, you're just like dying to stay awake. And that little extra hit of flavor is the thing that keeps you awake and lifts your spirit. Traditional postpartum foods do have a lot of benefits. Of course, they are culturally important, and there are storytellers, right? There's a whole history in every bowl. There's stories about how certain foods can bring you back from the brink of death. There's stories about how, the spirits and entities in our cultural legends, named these things and how they've been cared for throughout all of our history. So food is not just food to be extracted, but when we ingest it, it does provide a lot of benefits to us. And some people really speak this language, and it kind of validates, our traditional scientific frameworks. Of course, they're high in minerals, and we have high mineral needs after going through something so epic and, healing our body and everything coming back into place after pregnancy, and certainly the extra calorie needs that we have as well. They tend to be very high in collagen, which is the building block for our healing, beneficial to our tissues and mucosa, beneficial to healing any kind of birth injury or incision, supportive to the closure of the vasculature, inside the uterus, which begins to happen right away after the birth of the placenta. Such a fantastic healing, site for us. Takes time, and the closure of those vasculature are supported by foods that are high in collagen. Our body does make collagen on its own, but we can also take it in through foods. And our traditional foods speed up wound healing and digestion. Take something as simple and humble as the pumpkin. And how many people grew up not knowing that pumpkins were actually edible? I love this story my husband tells. He tells me that you have pumpkin pie and it comes in a can, right? And you never really think about the fact that somebody had to grow the pumpkin, harvest the pumpkin, take the stem off, take the seeds out to preserve the seeds for the next generation, roast it, take the meat out, blend it up, and then that is the can, right? That's before you. And he always says, it was not until I met you that I knew pumpkins were actually edible, because we just reconnected to pumpkin as a traditional food. And pumpkin is a word in English that really represents a lot of different types of gourds and squashes. And so there's just dozens and dozens of types of pumpkin, but something so simple and humble as the little pumpkin that we all just throw out into the woods. So much food wasted because of the holidays. It is in it of itself, it has nutrients inside that are wound healing. Same with zucchini, right? It's the first pumpkin. It's the first pumpkin of the year. It'll hopefully start popping up for us here in Michigan in the summertime. And when you let them go, they get big. The people at the farmer's market will come with these huge, huge zucchini. We're used to the ones at the store that are just these little tiny things. But that alone is wound healing. And when I learned that, I was like, whoa, it's so profound. Just the amount of nutrients that are here and all the benefits of something so simple as a little pumpkin. And then it speeds up digestion. And digestion is in Ayurvedic scientific and cultural frameworks, the root of health. And it has helped me to learn from Ayurveda teachers and practitioners, because again, I would hear these little bits and pieces about the importance of digestion or metabolism in Ojibwe culture, and never really had the language to talk about why it's so helpful. And now I can understand, because of those other, other traditions and the care and keeping of those cultures, that It is the absorption of our nutrients. It is the speed and ability in which we can fight off illnesses and pathogens. It's the ease and the fluidity of how water can move through our body, including urination, bowel movements, of course, but also milk flowing, blood flowing, and just the general kind of juiciness of life. That's digestion. It's not just about taking things in and then waste going out. It's really how good or how strong is our inner fire burning, and how quickly can we take things in and actually keep all of the nutrients. Traditional foods promote blood building. And I love this concept in TCM that talks about how the building blocks, the substrate, like the substance that is in our bone marrow, is the same. It'll either become blood or it'll become milk. And so everything that is supportive to blood building and building up our own ability to make blood, circulate it through the body, as well as to have a healthy blood volume in our body at any given time, is therefore innately supportive of milk building. And this kind of a diet is very lubricating, and lubricating is really important because, one, you know, we want smooth digestion. We want easy digestion in the postpartum period. We have a lot of fear and stigma around elimination in postpartum, and we scare the crap out of people literally when the only thing we ever tell them is, oh, wait till you have to go to the bathroom after your baby. It's going to be terrible. And it's the only thing that we ever tell people about postpartum healing. But it's not culturally relevant because our traditional care practices promote digestion, and the first, you know, bowel movements after birth are supposed to be easy. And I'd like to uplift that our traditional foods are just fancy. They're not just extra. They are, in fact, foundational to our life. They are foundational to our well-being. In a lot of professional birth spaces, you will often hear our traditional foods be dismissed as if they are just nice to have. You'll hear that, you know, especially in the professional lactation world, that there's no such thing as galactagogues, and that traditional foods do not help with milk. And you can never, ever say that our traditional foods are actually galactagogues. And certainly there's a lot of reasons, a lot of factors that that are at work when it comes to the milk making process. However, it's not right to dismiss the importance of our traditional foods. We often hear that, oh, well, traditional foods are only galactagogues because they boost oxytocin. And it's like dismissing oxytocin as, oh, it's just the feel-good hormone. And it's just extra. If our maternity care here in the United States is in a state of crisis, and life in the United States doesn't even really support feeling good at all, hardly ever. In fact, the systems of oppression that were meant to annihilate many of us here in this very room are ongoing today. And oxytocin is not to be brushed aside as it's not that important. And it's just treated as like, well, you get a gold star because you give 1 hour of bonding and 1 hour of uninterrupted breastfeeding after birth. And then it's back to everything else that diminishes oxytocin. Oxytocin is not just a byproduct. It's not an accident. It's not just an extra fancy thing. It is itself a life-saving hormone that prevents excessive bleeding in postpartum. It promotes bonding, which is the foundation of our humanity, the foundation of our brain building as infants, the way that we establish trust in the world around us. It has everything to do with our cultural concepts of care and safety and well-being. And it is crucial to the milk making process, right? Prolactin is what brings the milk, and oxytocin makes it come out. And so I want to stop and disrupt this idea that oxytocin is just extra. And in fact, it is itself a life-saving hormone. And so that's the only thing you remember tonight. I would be fine with that. There are for sure, you know, lots of, you know, different protocols and stories about the foods that are taboo in postpartum. And I always like to tread very cautiously here, or just with a lot of care and intention, because I never want to come in and say, you cannot do this thing, or if you do this, it is bad or wrong. I never want to come in with that kind of energy. And so I have discussions with people about the taboo foods for postpartum healing and talk about why they are taboo and why we might choose to, if we can, avoid or minimize taking in these taboo things. And of course, there's going to be different, you know, protocols for each and every family, each and every community. It's going to be, you know, intuitively that certain things are very repulsive to someone in various phases of their life, certainly during pregnancy and postpartum. And people need to eat, period. And so if all they have is this, and that is the thing that makes them happy, and that's what they have access to, then I'll never judge that. And so I don't come into people's houses as a postpartum doula and like judge what they have or judge what they have access to. So this is really just uplifted in a really, you know, gentle way to keep us all accountable to our people and the families that we serve in a very non-judgmental and graceful kind of manner. And that being said, there's definitely some taboos and things that we want to minimize and avoid if we can for any length of time. You know, for some people, they can just do a week. For some people, it's going to be the full 40 days. For me, I'm a person that carries, you know, multiple intersections of privilege, and I have the ability to eat this kind of a diet really for the first year postpartum, because just that's what I connect to. And I happen to have all my babies in the wintertime. And so like 6 weeks of the warmth and the easy digestible things isn't really enough for me. So it's just different things for different people. And all of it is just understanding that every family is different and unique. That being said, cold and ice things are the number one thing to avoid. It's the number one taboo food in just about every single cultural tradition around postpartum healing, for all the reasons that we've already said. Things that are overly spicy and acidic, because they are irritating to the opening, you know, that healing space inside the uterus, the site of the placental detachment, can cause too much heat in the body, meaning too much bleeding. And it can just be a little overwhelming or a little irritating to have things that are super spicy. Now, I definitely have observed the tolerance for spice is very different depending on who you are, what you've grown up eating, and what lineage you come from. I learned from a really fantastic an elder, a mom and a grandma who is from India, and she's an Ayurvedic practitioner. And I was watching her make this chicken soup, and she was cutting up these jalapenos. And I said, well, you know, Auntie, and I've heard from a lot of people that we shouldn't have things that are too spicy or too acidic in postpartum. And so I noticed that you were cutting up these jalapenos, and she didn't devein them or nothing. She just literally cut them up. And in her tradition, everything is cooked first, and then you add like the peppers and the onions and the spices are cooked beforehand, and then you add in everything else. So she was throwing those jalapenos in there, and she said, oh yeah, well, if you want to reduce the spice, then you just use one jalapeno instead of like jalapenos. So, you know, the tolerance to spice definitely just depends on who you are and where you're from and what you're accustomed to. I've certainly had clients who really enjoy very spicy things and they can handle a little heat, and then others who can't handle any heat. And so it's all good. High acidic foods, especially like chiles and peppers and tomatoes and things that are just more of those raw kind of summer foods, can be introduced gently back into the postpartum diet, but certainly wouldn't go hard with those in the first few meals postpartum. We do try to avoid raw, crunchy, and crispy foods. That is because they are hard to digest. They can cause excess air in the intestines, and our body has to just work extra hard to digest things like that. Whereas if they come into our body already cooked and already warm, then our body is much, it's much easier for our body to digest them. And then phlegm and gassy foods. And again, this is going to be different for each person. And phlegm foods, the way I like to describe it is those foods that you eat that you instantly feel sick from eating. And that causes you inflammation in your mucosa immediately upon eating it. So for me, it's always the same. It's pizza and pasta. If I eat pasta, I just know it's a phlegm food for me. I know that soon as I eat it, I'm going to get stuffy. My head's going to get stuffy. I'm going to feel a stuffy nose. And I know that the next morning when I wake up, I'm going to be sneezing with a runny nose. And that's because my body is like phlegm overload from that. And does that mean I never eat pizza? Of course not. I eat it all the time. Every goddamn week I eat pizza. But in postpartum, in the first like 6 weeks, I'm like, okay, let me just try to get through without that, because I know it's going to make me feel like crap. I know it's going to make me constipated. I know I'm going to be sneezing, and I just don't want to be miserable with like extra inflammation when I am healing from birth. And same with things that are gassy. And that's just, you know, depends on each person and what their body is used to. And I have tried so hard to think about how can I make a postpartum pizza, and I still haven't figured it out. My only advice is to have soup before you eat the pizza and then to have something warm to drink after. All right. So as Indigenous people, we have so much that we're always up against, and everything is just never so simple as postpartum foods, and everything is so beautiful and Instagrammable, and like, look at all these beautiful colors. We always have something else lurking in the background that we have to think about. Indigenous people, we can never just like rest at night. We got to think about all these other things. So when it comes to food and nutrition, it's not enough to just know what and why we eat certain things, but we have to have an understanding that there's a community and cultural context that we're operating within that we have to also be aware of. And as birth workers, as doulas, as helpers, we have to also advocate for and be aware of movements around food sovereignty and food access. We know that not every family has equal access to food. We know that there's certain communities where the price of food is so high. We know that there could be transportation issues. We know that the preservation of foods and our traditional practices have been disrupted for so many reasons and by so many different factors. And so we just want to know that and take it into account. Look around in your community and ask yourself, what barriers exist for your community in terms of accessing postpartum food? But what ways are we so creative about our food access too? We know that there's people with eating disorders who have, you know, particular procedures or restrictions around eating. And so I'm always very careful about that. I don't ever just... I try not to like shove a plate of food into somebody's face and like sit there
and expect them to eat it, because people who have disordered eating behaviors often have like particular ways that they cut things or particular order that they eat things, or they don't necessarily want to have somebody sitting there with them. It's not so much of a shared experience as it is more of a private or personal experience. And so again, absolutely no shame. And I'm not here to like, I'm not a therapist, and so I don't help people with eating disorders in that way. But if I'm feeding somebody, I will just make it available for them to do their thing without me like hovering over them. Now, certainly, not everyone does that. And so I definitely can sit on the couch with somebody and like go, you know, into some food, but it's not appropriate for every situation. And so just use a lot of discernment in noticing if someone's not really digging into the food. You don't have to ask them, oh, hey, do you have an eating disorder? But just kind of back off and let them get into the food when they're ready. And it could be that they're going to do that when you're not there. So a lot of different ways that we can package things and make them available for people afterwards. We'd certainly want to be aware of any allergies and food restrictions. And I do this in a very gentle way and in a very non-shaming, non-judgmental way. I do just ask people, you know, if they're vegetarian, if they're vegan, I'll talk through the reasons. Sometimes it's cultural reasons or religious restrictions. Sometimes it's just that people are turned off by certain foods, or that certain foods have been repulsive to them in their pregnancy, or that, you know, they didn't grow up eating certain types of food and they're open to it now. You know, there's various reasons why people don't eat certain things. So I'll just kind of, you know, gently ask them, what do you want me to prepare? And is there anything that you don't want that I should avoid? I found out that a lot of people are allergic to plantain. And I cook with so much plantain. Like it's kind of like nettles for me, because I can dry it. I just sprinkle it into everything. And like, I've had at least two families in the past year who've had plantain allergies. And now I have to be more conscientious about putting that in there. The same with, you know, like mullein and yarrow and things that can kind of be cross-contaminated with other allergies that people have very commonly in this region. So talking about allergies, really important. And of course, as Indigenous people, you know, water is life, not just a saying, but really foundational to our responsibilities to the land and our kinship structure, having a lot to do with water. And we know that there's not equitable access to water in First Nations communities all across Turtle Island. We're facing so many crises in here in Michigan, for instance. You know, we had this nationally known problem called the Flint water crisis, where a lot of families in Flint, Michigan, which just happens to be a working class, primarily Black community, were being poisoned with lead because of the structures in the housing in that community being so old and being really kind of run down. And people were getting sick from it, and several people died from that. And the city of Flint still doesn't have it. Like, there's not water in every single home in Flint, Michigan, still to this day. And this was almost 10 years ago now. And so what does it mean for a doula who works in Flint? How do you cook food? How do you prepare teas, right? How do you do that if you live in a community where it's water is brought in? When I'm at ceremony, we don't have running water, but it's not the same. It's not the same. So what do you do if the water is contaminated? You know, how do we bring nutrition to people? We can bring in water in bottles, but we know that there's leaching of the plastic into the bottles. So we have to be warriors in so many different ways. And I give us a lot of respect and love, because like I said, we can never just sleep at night. We got to think about all these other things. But for sure, you know, we have to just be aware that water is a finite resource. and cultural appropriation integrity. And I trust everyone here, right? I do. And I just like to give a little disclaimer that not everything is for everybody. And we don't have to know everything, and we don't have to do everything, and we don't have to take from other cultures that are not our own without permission. And there's ways of borrowing and exchanging and being respectful. And I know everyone in this audience already does that. It's easy for outsiders to look in and be like, oh yeah, look at the natives. They have so many great traditions, and like, look at this. And then all of a sudden you turn around and bone broth is $7 a quart at the store, which then makes it inaccessible to Indigenous people who were the caretakers of this medicine. So it's more of, an awareness of how things can be culturally appropriated, especially to be stolen from us as Indigenous people. And then for Black and Indigenous people in particular, when we're working in roles of service, it is super valid to have an awareness of sometimes there's power dynamics within the families or the homes that we're in that can make us feel like we're the hired help. And I would never ever shame a doula or a birth worker or a postpartum chef or caterer for walking away from situations where they feel like their skills are undervalued and that they're just there to cook. And for me, so while I see that as an honor, it's because I work with Indigenous people. Now it'd be very different for me if I was hired out of the blue for a white family and they just wanted me to come in and cook for them. I might be feeling a little different about the dynamic there. So it's certainly very valid to just take in and own your feelings unapologetically and find situations where you feel like you as the caregiver are also respected and also treated with a lot of love and respect, the same love and respect that we give to the families we work with. Hot herbal teas are such a great medicine for us in postpartum, high in minerals, warming the womb. They promote digestion. Importantly, they really soothe the nerves and prevent anxiety, especially at nighttime. And there's just so many different herbs in all of our different, geographic locations and in traditional, in our lineages and in just the different ways we've shared across regions and across cultures. They have so many benefits, including restoring the blood lost, and especially with nettles, coming back to nettles again. And they provide this stimulation of the spirit, like the positive stimulation of the spirit. A negative stimulation of the spirit is like scrolling through your phone or watching the news or, viewing a car accident or, things that like get you really hyped and have those like stress response hormones spiking. Those are negative stimulation of the spirit, but positive stimulation are the ones that pull us out of feeling too tired or pull us out of feeling too depressed or lift our mood and just give us a little, I think of it as like a little bit of movement inside, like a little bit of movement. It just gives me a reminder to like stay awake and stay alert and be present in the moment. And I love hot herbal teas for that reason. And so I want to end by sharing my favorite recipe, which is for really protecting and uplifting the health of the womb, in particular in postpartum, just because it's so packed with nutrients. It's really helping to balance out fluid. It moves lymph, which promotes our immunity. It's protective of our blood supply, therefore our milk supply. And it's just toning to the muscles and the vasculature and just so supportive in so many ways. And it's very simple. It's equal parts dried stinging nettle leaf, oat straw, red clover leaf and flower, and red raspberry leaf. And I put dried because where I live, we have four seasons and they're so distinctly beautiful in their own ways. But we have to preserve food where I live because we have very long and very cold winters and we don't have access to fresh things throughout the year. So dried herbs is what I usually have access to 3 out of 4 seasons of the year. So a lot of what I do is dried and I'm very familiar and comfortable working with dried. But this is folk herbalism. It's not clinical herbalism. So you could certainly do different variations of this and fresh teas would be also appropriate and really fantastic. So with that, I will end the presentation and let everyone know that we are going to move into our discussion and sharing.
All right. Thank you so much, Rhianne. And I wanted to just, thank you. Your recipes and your, do you want to just share if people did want to access your recipe book, a way that they could do that?
Yeah, I am for sure going to send out a sampler. So I'll have a couple different recipes that I'll send to everyone who registered. And then I do have a link to purchase my whole book, which is 40 recipes for 40 days. And I can send that in a follow-up as well.
Okay. Yeah. And so that would just be because people don't register for this in particular. Okay. And it's in no way the same, but I wanted to also just share the book that we're working on and show the art about nettles, just to bring that in for today. And so I just wanted to share that this is also in development, and we had a retreat last week of just bringing us all together. And so I just wanted to share that there's going to be even more possibilities available. And I think that, you have really just brought alive a lot of the work of, feeding people in postpartum. And what I really just see is that there is this extreme motivation of people to come back to their traditional ways, or where there's a part that just gets awakened when they start growing the next generation. And so it can just be such a powerful time for people to ask questions that maybe they didn't before, or to have intentionality in what they're taking in, or for some people, the first time their bodies had such an extreme challenge with the changes of growing a baby. And I wanted to also just share that there are a couple of other Zoomcast episodes that are specifically focused on food. One of my favorite ones is with Margaret David and Autumn Cavender Wilson, that's called First Breaths to First Foods, and where they just share a lot of beautiful recipes and just conversation about being pregnant people and birthing people and postpartum people, and Alaska Native and Dakota foods. And then also Sewa has an episode on making atole, and adding in the chocolate and the cinnamon and just how healing that corn porridge is in postpartum. So just to share those other resources, this particular guide, when we first started the draft, it was because in the Indigenous Child Birth Educator Training Program, that was one of the assignments, was for people to just research some foods from their lineage. And it just was beautiful, some of the things that people were coming back, the stories that they were, hearing from their elders, or the thinking and, the just sharing that was happening as an intertribal conversation. And so I wrote a grant to the First Nations Development Institute for the Breastfeeding and First Foods grant. And then, just the nettle page, I had thought we could do, 2-page spreads on, I
the first section is creator superfoods, which of course nettle is there, and then foods by nations, so the wisdom of our nations, for people who are trying to reconnect to their lineage and know that their body craves and loves some things that are specific to their bloodline, and then also by issues, so pages on things like blood building for anemia, and you know, foods for things like constipation, or ideas on recipes to prepare electrolytes during labor, just things like that. And so it quickly became that we couldn't have two-page spreads, and so we've shifted it to just making complete PDFs for each of these topics. So now, you know, we have so far like 12 pages on nettles, and where we can just keep adding new recipes, and where it's information on things in all the different ways, and that people can bring it in with wherever they are in their pregnancy and parenting journeys. So, you know, recipes to teach their children, you know, recipes to grow their baby, considerations for labor, considerations for immediate postpartum, and as well as later. So I just wanted to share about that, and we'll be talking more. We're going to be releasing some of these initial PDFs, but like I said, instead of it being a guide, we instead are turning it into a library, so that, you know, people can just download the PDF on nettles and download the PDF on, you know, on foods for different nations, just whatever it is that they're looking for, and that it can just keep growing and growing. So I wanted to share that, and also just show the beautiful artwork from my tribal member, Sarah Folden, who drew this and has also just has beautiful photos that we'll be adding. So I wanted to share that. And then at this time, I wanted to, for those that are just knowing, I shared earlier that at this point in time, we can just edit out anything that people want to. So if you want to ask a question or share a story or any of those things, and you don't need to explain a reason, you know, maybe it's just that you don't like having your voice recorded, or, you know, that it's a vulnerable topic or anything at all, just say when you're speaking that you want this deleted off of the video. And Marissa, our tech assistant, just completely takes care of that. So I just wanted to share that. Well, I'm going to change the settings now so that people can unmute themselves. Brianne, have you fixed this? Or do you know where is it? Just changing the setting. Give me one moment.
Yeah, no problem. People can enter into the chat too if you have any questions, but you don't want to come unmute.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, I found it. All right. So the setting has now officially been changed. And then if you, I think sometimes people just don't want to unmute themselves because they're worried about interrupting, or then you can also just raise your hand and we can, you know, say your name as well.
I have a question, maybe for everybody, but it's about eating the placenta, and I don't know any, like, North American or just to like Turtle Island traditions that do that. But I live on the West Coast where it's very common. So I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Oh, yes. That's the eternal question in every doula training. And it's a really good question. And I always start with, you know, no judgment or shame. I believe people find their way to the medicine that's right for them. And so I'm never to interfere. So if someone is like feeling really called to that, and that is the thing that their spirit helpers are guiding them towards, then more power to them. However, in our traditions here, we typically do not ingest the placenta. In non-violence and like non-cutting of it is really prioritized in our culture because the placenta is so sacred and is treated with a lot of reverence. And so we're, you know, it would be somewhat taboo for us to do that. It's not to say that in a life-saving situation, placenta is there and for sure has been, you know, used throughout all of history as a life-saving medicine for different reasons in postpartum, but most communities that I've taught in have very similar kind of beliefs that it is to be treated as a very strong medicine, and it's not really a universally appropriate thing that we would all just take in. It's, you know, even in Chinese medicine, considered to be used in specific ways and is not just something that everyone needs because we already have such sophisticated, you know, beliefs and protocols about postpartum well-being. Sometimes where I see placenta fitting into that is in the absence of those traditional practices. So in cultures, you know, in communities where they don't have such strong family structures in place and they don't have those traditional foods and they don't have those aunties, or, you know, taking care of them, then the way that they prevent those health problems is through placenta. And so it's more of bridging the gap for me. But I'll, you know, just share that with a totally open heart and non-judgment whatsoever. It's not bad to do it. And I would never stigmatize someone for doing it. It's just not our go-to here, but I'll for sure give space if anyone here wants to share their perspective or experience as well.
Yeah, I would love, I've explored and asked, and, you know, I think that there's a lot of people really, really passionate, and, you know, in my area, you know, a lot of my clients, Indigenous, and where nearly all of my clients are Indigenous, and some of them are choosing to do so. But I have personally yet to speak with someone who was doing so, and they were told that that's what their people had done, if that makes sense. I've yet to have that shared with me, and I've asked a lot, and in our Indigenous birthkeeper gatherings and in all the places I've traveled and been invited in conferences, I have yet to find, it's just so such a universal, not universal, but such a more common experience to plant the roots of our babies in our lands, and a recognition that it's not just the body of the birth, a something that was belongs to the birth giver, but that is the babies. And that's part of why I feel like that comes to be is, and I have people said, you know, I am disconnected from my territories and my lands, and I don't trust that I could bury the placenta in a place that would be honored or respected, and it feels safest to just stay with me. And so they took that in a really powerful way of I'm going to stay, I can't plant the roots of my baby in my ancestral land. So I will do that work by having it stay in my body. But yeah, if anyone at any time hears from others that that's something their elders have stories of, I'd love to hear. But that hasn't been my experience as of yet. Rianne, do you want to share about your, or just what you wrote, that there's a link to your recipe guide and just what you shared in the comment for those who are listening and won't see the thread?
Yes, so I do have a recipe guide. It is 40 recipes for 40 days. I had a colleague who challenged me because I always do this soup of the day on Facebook, and she was like, do you think you could get to 40 soups for 40 days? So I did accept the challenge. I have 40 recipes for 40 days is the name of my cookbook, and it is available for download at my website, which is postpartumhealinglodge.teachable.com, and you can find it on there, and I'm happy to share it for anyone who has a cost or otherwise barrier for free, and organizations can just purchase that for one time and share it with community as well. So just really want to have the knowledge be out there, and it's got soups, stews, bone broths, lots of vegetable dishes, wild rice. It really highlights a lot of Great Lakes food. So lots of fish, lots of venison, lots of corn, Three Sisters, things that are all really great, ranging from immediate first bites of food all the way to, the first year or two of breastfeeding.
Great. Joanne.
I'm going to turn on my video so you guys can see me. I actually took a look at your link and I really like it. I work for, I'm not Indigenous, but I work for Sagamuck Anishinaabeg, which is in between Sudbury, Ontario and Sault Ste. Marie, Northern Ontario. We live along, I live in Elliott Lake, but Sagamuck is near Lake Huron. And I am the parent, infant, and child support worker. I'm both a social worker and a perinatal support worker. It's actually a newer program that we have in Ontario that is basically put the doula program into a medical thing. So we can get registered once our personal support workers can be registered in Ontario. But anyway, so I work with moms and babies, home visits. I'm connecting with the local midwives here. I work with Mama Wessing, which is another Indigenous organization that works in health. And we're working on FASD prevention. We're hoping later this year to do a Women's Wellness Day. And that is our FASD prevention. So we're going to, I'm going to get our traditional healers from Sagamuck to talk about all of the traditional herbs they use here. And I want to start it with teenagers. And I want to have this program. This is my vision for it, is to have it all the way to menopause. So, definitely looking into all those things. So I will be going and looking to see if I can, I might just buy it myself, or I'll ask my manager if we can buy it. But that does look like an awesome thing, because food sovereignty is such a big thing right now with post-COVID and the prices of going sky high. A lot of the programming that I'm doing on top of all these things is gardening and greenhouse and community kitchens, and getting back to those roots of being connected with the land, whether it's foraging or gardening. So all of those things. And I've heard some stories about placentas in Sagamuck, and some of the grandmothers were talking about where they used to plant, where they used to put their placentas. And I'm like, oh, so this is a known thing. They know where that spot is in their community. And it's a very, being that we're in such a northern place, it is very unspoiled. So there's forests and rocks and trees and lakes and streams everywhere. So I don't even know where this place is, but it would be an honor to take part in something like that, or to, you know, to hear how I do believe it's the men who would plant bury the placentas. But for that I've also talked with in Sudbury, that's our major center for, you know, birth and stuff in hospital. We have a Dr. Jocko, who is an Indigenous OBGYN. And I've been in a Zoom with her and Naomi Wolf, who is an Indigenous midwife, plus there's two more in on the North Shore called North Channel Midwifery. So I'm actually connecting with that. With Haley tomorrow, so one of the midwives from that group, to, you know, work with the moms who are breastfeeding. And there's just so much support that I want to do and so much vision that I have for, you know, for the North, for the community that I work in. And I want to learn more and more. And right now my daughter is actually in the Anishinaabeg Educational Institute, which is in North Bay, also in London, Ontario. And she's taking Native Community Worker and Traditional Healing Methods. And there is so much amazing stuff. There's a book, one of her textbooks was called Boreal Herbal, which Rayanne, I think you might have heard of, or you might know of. She's also taking a course, I think next semester, that's ethnobotany. And I think I've talked to the school and I think I want to take it myself, because I like, you can never have enough information. Like, I'm always wanting to learn more and more. So I'm learning as much as I'm facilitating programming in the community and helping the moms that are there. And the thing I hear echoed over and over again, whether it's an elder or a younger person, it's always getting back to connecting with culture, connecting with language. And that is also connecting with medicines. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Joanne. And hi from across the river. I'm in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. I don't think I said that at the beginning, but you're right across the river.
I was actually looking to see if this was recorded earlier, because I thought it was at 3 p.m. Eastern time, because that's when it kind of put it into my calendar, and I was still at work in meeting, so I couldn't join it. And I'm like, maybe it was recorded and I can go watch it. So I'm kind of just snagging onto the, you know, after it had already started. But it's pretty.
So yes, the recordings are usually within 3 days or so. The recordings are posted, and you use the recording not just, you know, for a lot of the ways that people are using them is just for resources to share with your clients. And so then as they're preparing for their birth, and you know that they can hear the wisdom of Rayanne and be able to just share it easily without, you know, it just always, it can be just direct from the source. And so that's part of the reason that I wanted those Zoomcasts to just be growing as a library. So then when people ask us just specific questions, or you have clients who are wanting to just dive deeper into specific topics, that they can, you know, go and access the recordings or listen to it on a podcast, however they want to do that. So it's for us as birth workers, it's to share and to inform our people that we're working with and loving on. And people come in at very different places in their journey. You know, some people are, you know, food sovereignty is a big part of their life, and they, you know, have freezer full of just things that they're connected to that are their people's medicine. And other people, it's a really amazing time as they ask you, you know, my doctor told me I need, you know, to take iron pills. Is there another option? And you can talk about you know, whether even in addition to anything that is given prescription, that we can just nourish our bodies in these ways that are gentler and for longevity. And it doesn't just nurture our bodies, it nurtures the spirit too. It's a really important gateway for a lot of people. I know, you know, with my granddaughter, this last year, just being able to think of, you know, what are the tastes that I wish that, you know, I had been introduced to in a different way. I mean, I've definitely struggled with food in a huge way as an adult. And, you know, the fact that we could intentionally introduce her to each one of these traditional foods deliberately and intentionally, and with the ceremonies and the prayers that went with it, you know, it's healing us as well as, you know, introducing, you know, starting a pathway for our little ones to just experience all over again, a decolonized way of living. So food, it cannot be spoken enough. It's one of my most important, you know, roles as a midwife, as a person in this work that I'm doing, to just help people connect and find, you know, healing with the foods they bring in.
Yeah, thanks for that, Rhonda. Appreciate it. We did have a question come through. How long can the womb wellness tea be continued? A few things about the womb tea that I shared. So the red raspberry, the red clover, the oat straw, and the nettles. It is ever so slightly drying. And in the context of eating all of the other things, like the broths and the soups and the casseroles, is fine in and of itself. However, if you were to just drink it on its own and you were eating things that were also drying, then it could be a little too drying for somebody in postpartum. The way to remedy that is to serve it with maple syrup or honey. And you never want to bring it to boil, because then you can denature all of the benefits of the syrup or the honey, and it has to be real syrup, right? 100% pure maple syrup. So, it is also very energizing. Nettles is really, really effective at moving water in the body. So when I drink it, I can literally feel my body vibrating. And it's way too strong to drink at nighttime for me, because if I drink that at night, I would never get to sleep. I'd just be laying there like, I can literally feel like the buzzing sensation. So it's very energizing. It's really good for morning time or whenever somebody has to be awake. The effect of it is that it's like, it's very stimulating, has a real strong, deep, dark green, earthy kind of flavor to it. It's very dark in color when you brew it. And so it follow the body and follow the reaction of the person taking it. But for me, having a few strong cups of it in the first week postpartum is really fantastic. And then, you know, when their menstruation returns, it's a really great one to have either during menstruation or right after, because it brings back that energy. It brings the water back into balance. It helps with iron. It brings blood back into balance too. If someone takes it and it makes them feel jittery, or you know, they just haven't a feeling of it's too strong for them, you could water it down and you can add the sweetener as well. But it's generally food safe, right? It's not clinical herbalism, so it's generally food safe, and one or two nice strong cups of it a day for the first week postpartum can be really supportive.
I'll just add also that I personally recommend for people, in order to just really have as much of the minerals released into the water as possible, to do an overnight infusion. And to be able to, especially, I tend to not have the red clover for just not necessarily concerned with it, but just because the other three, aren't estrogenic and are just way more accessible to, red clover is accessible too, but it's just a much more common mineral rich tea in particular. But this blend is, as far as for how long to take it, I mean, it's recommended to do this blend during menopause. As postpartum as you can be getting at that point in time in life. So it is very healthy and helpful, but I really love the nettles, oat straw, and various berry leaves too. So here in the Pacific Northwest, people are gathering, thimbleberry and salmonberry and even blackberry leaf too, just to have as a mineral tea at later times too. So the red clover and the red raspberry are specifically for the womb, but just in terms of supporting, osteoporosis and just overall, just the sacrifices our body does to grow our babies, and replacing those minerals can be really important.
Yeah, great discussion. All right. Well, I can hear my kids are going nuts downstairs because it's just about bedtime. Actually, it's past bedtime and we have a really long bedtime routine. So I'm going to just extend a lot of gratitude to you all for being here and for the great questions and for the sharing and all of the seeds that have been planted that I know you'll carry out to your people in a good way, and just pray that everything good will be returned to you all tenfold and that we'll get to reconnect in another space and time, hopefully again very soon. So appreciative of all the familiar faces, Margaret, and I thought I saw Thayil Dahini was here. So I'll just appreciate each of you for being here and sharing the space with me and always supporting.
Thank you, Rayanne. That's, going to be on my list of favorite Zoom casts as well. I loved the simplicity, but so clear of, the core pieces of what we're trying for in helping to nurture people in postpartum, and that there's so many possibilities in how we can do that. Cups of tea and kindness, and doesn't have to be luxury, deluxe, specific anything. There's lots of ways to help people heal and connect. So that came right through in your presentation. I'm thankful for that.
Thank you so much. And thank you for keeping the tradition. It is not only for Native Americans, it's for all humanity. And your people have been telling everybody for centuries. Now let's hope they start to listen. And thank you for giving me this wonderful information and insight. I appreciate it.
Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it. Thanks so much.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and end the recording. And yes, I'm just thank you all again and have a good evening. And if you did hop on late or you want to refer the edited version, just go to the Center for Indigenous Midwifery website in the next week and it will be available for you.
All right, thanks everybody.
Good
night. See you. Good night.
Hi, Carla.
Thank you so much. Good night.
Hey, Quitch.